Morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us again. Today we have Caleb McKellar from Andre Pinine Associates, and he's joining us to discuss the decriminalization of dacha and how the use of it can impact employers and employees going forward. Caleb works, as I mentioned, for Andre Pinar and Associates, and they do commercial legal work and litigation disputes between juristic entities, including companies, trusts, and like, as well as disputes between directors, shareholders, and they've also dealt with CCMA cases and labor disputes. Welcome, Caleb.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us a bit more about what you do and what Andre Pinine Associates specialize in?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to the commercial and litigation, we obviously litigate in the High Court, the Magistrates Court, and various other arbitration forums in South Africa, Labour Courts included, and the CCMA. And what we try and do from a litigation point of view is apply the best strategy possible for our clients, especially in this cost-sensitive environment that we currently are in. And from a commercial point of view as well, we try and use our experience in litigation to better assist our clients drafting their employment contracts, for example, their shareholder agreements, using the experience from where the disputes arise to inform how the contract should be drafted to, number one, avoid those disputes, and number two, if the dispute arises, how best to manage and deal with that dispute.
That sounds interesting. I think a lot of companies, you know, just get out of the starting blocks without doing those agreements properly. So there's definitely opportunity there for people to get those contracts in place from the word go, so that, you know, you start with a divorce in mind almost.
Absolutely. I think a lot of companies start with an MOI, which is standardized, and they don't understand that the Companies Act provides for alterable and non-alterable provisions in the MOI, which allows directors and also shareholders some scope to negotiate and set up a company to suit their best interests and needs from day one.
Perfect. But obviously, you mentioned you have dealt with quite a few labor disputes and CCMA cases as well, and that's the reason for our discussion today, where the Constitutional Court has ordered the decriminalization of dacha for personal use. Quite a controversial topic at the moment, and that has had an effect for employers and employees alike. Maybe you can start by just telling us a bit more, what does it mean when we say that the Constitutional Court has ordered that decriminalization? Is it now carte blanche for everyone? What does it actually say?
So must remember that the Constitutional Court has decriminalized use, possession, and cultivation for adults, so those persons over 18 years of age in South Africa. Although the order granted is an interim order, it's an interim order for 2 years, and it's given the legislature the chance to redraft the provisions which have been found to be unconstitutional. And I won't go into the exact details, but they're provisions relating to the Drugs and Drugs Trafficking Control Act and the Medicines Act. For now, that's not what's important. I think what's important for us is, why did they make that decision? What was the rationale for making that decision? And in essence, the court found that the right to use, cultivate, and possess dacha falls under your right to privacy, which is entrenched in Section 14 of the Constitution. And drawing on both local and foreign jurisprudence, that's often what the Constitutional Court will do, is look at other countries and how they are moving. They concluded that the right to privacy entitles an adult to use or cultivate or possess cannabis in private for his or her personal consumption. It's important to note that private doesn't necessarily only mean a household. The court left that open to say that private spaces might be defined as something more than just a household, which will inform part of our discussion later.
Yes.
But for now, I think that's a good place to start. And also what's interesting about the judgment is that they cited a report published by the World Health Organization on the health and social consequences of non-medical cannabis use. Now, don't ask me how they came to this report, but they obviously found the necessary people to take part. And the report indicated that the adverse health and social consequences of cannabis use reported by cannabis users who seek treatment for dependence appears to be less than those reported by persons dependent on alcohol or opioid.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So they concluded that alcohol and opioid is more harmful than cannabis, and that kind of informed part of the decision that they made.
Okay.
Importantly, though, is the purchase of cannabis has not been decriminalized.
Yes.
So it's kind of left a bit of a loophole.
Yes.
Where does anyone purchase this cannabis that they're now going to be cultivating or using? But we'll leave that for now.
Okay, so just to summarize, you know, it has been decriminalized. It's talking about use in privacy or private space, which would mean at my residence, or as you mentioned, even the private space is open for discussion. But surely this now has an impact on a lot of employers. There's two sides to it. The one side being what is the duties and the implication to the employer, but also what are the rights for the employee that now chooses to use this in their private space or private privacy, own privacy. And I think that's going to be, you know, our focus for today is to unpack that and to understand what does it literally mean. It appears that, you know, it's not a black and white, clear-cut situation at this stage.
Yeah, definitely. So I think a good place to start then is how has it played out in the courts or in the CCMA since the judgment was given. And there's a case of Ntembu and Durban Wood Chips, which was a company in Durban that fired three employees for having cannabis found in their urine tests. And I think it's good for us to look at this judgment just briefly, because it has been handed down and it does stand.
Yes.
And to say what are the implications. And what's important about this particular judgment is the type of work environment that these individuals worked in. They worked as large machinery and dangerous vehicles, and they worked on almost a construction site for these wood chips. And the employer had a zero tolerance policy. And they tested positive for cannabis in their urine, three of these employees. And in addition to that, they admitted to being under the influence of Dacha at the time of taking the test, which,
yes,
I don't know if they did that under false understanding of what they were admitting to, or whether it was a genuine admittance. However, a lot of firms and companies have taken this judgment to mean that now if a urine test is done, that all employees can be dismissed on the basis that cannabis is found in their urine. There are some legal scholars out there who have indicated that this judgment possibly is incorrect, due to the fact that cannabis can remain in the urine for up to almost 30 days in some instances, whereas alcohol, when found in the urine or found in the breathalyzer, indicates immediate intoxication.
Yes. So the testing for Dacha use is not as straightforward as a breathalyzer test for alcohol. The common, cheap, and fast,
yes,
urine test that you buy over the counter, or, you know, even the test for cannabis use over the counters, you know, those fast ones detect a metabolic product that can linger for days, which would mean, you know, what happens if it shows Dacha use, but, you know, that was something that you did over the weekend 4 or 5 days ago. You know, so the question around it is, what test should be performed? In this case, they now performed a urine test, because according to some are of the opinion that the only test a company should ask for is a spectrophotometric test, which takes around 2 days, and the cost per test is about 2,000 rand, and I assume that cost would be for the employer. So you know, what is your opinion on tests? Should over-the-counter quick fast tests be used? Can urine tests be used, or should a spectrophotometric test be required by the company to really ascertain what the levels are?
I think it's quite clear that a urine test doesn't indicate intoxication for at least for cannabis. So that's definitely out of the picture as far as a viable testing method. As I advise all clients when it comes to testing, we need to go back just briefly to the Employment Equity Act and ensure that the testing complies with Section 7 therein. And in terms of that Section 7, the test must be permitted or required by law. Now, that obviously depend on the industry that the client is operating in or your employer is operating in. And, or it must be in light of medical fact, employment conditions, social policy, and fair distribution of employee benefits or an inherent requirements of the job. So I think a good example is a pilot. I think if a pilot was to test positive cannabis in his urine, it might be grounds for a review or something along those lines due to the fact that they're operating heavy machinery and operating in quite a controlled and rigid environment.
Yes.
But in a day-to-day office job, I don't believe that a urine test would be useful to prove that an employee was intoxicated at the time of testing if cannabis is found in that particular employee's urine. This test that you've mentioned, I've tried to look more into it. It seems to be quite few and far between online in terms of information about it and how to go about it. But I would recommend some sort of a blood test would need to be performed to assess the levels in the blood.
But in order for that to happen, if we go a step back, and this is purely from an employer point of view, the employer should, you know, obviously as it stands, go back to their current contracts of employment and code of conduct, because surely this test must be agreed to and must be of a voluntary nature by the employee. So what would be the first step for the employer from a contractual employment and code of conduct point of view, and secondly from an occupational health and safety point of view? What should they comply with contractually in order to do these tests, and what is their responsibility specifically with the use of cannabis, from occupational health and safety point of view?
I think employers must have mention of the intoxication policies, call it that, use that term for lack of a better word at this point in time, in the employment contract. So not only must it be a standalone policy, but it must be mentioned in the employment contract itself. And what's even more beneficial is if the policy is attached to the employment contract and then signed at the same time as the employment contract. What we often find in litigious disputes involving employers and employees, whether it be a restraint of trade or dismissal unfairly or otherwise, is that employees don't often sign, don't often even become aware of the policies that exist in the workplace. And I think now it's more than ever, it's more important that a policy dealing with intoxication is not only mentioned in the employment contract to stipulate what the essence of it, but that the policy itself is set out. And we can go through, if you want, more of the requirements for that particular policy.
Yeah, I think it's important for our clients and employers out there to understand what should be in there. Currently, you know, I think most of the employers have a general intoxication wording, and it's quite gray and wide, where it just mentions that, you know, this is their stance on intoxication, but it has not been adjusted and it has not been aligned to be more suitable after the Constitutional Court ruling has changed. So yeah, perhaps you can guide us on, for the sake of our clients and employers, what should be part of that.
So again, it's very difficult now for employers to test for cannabis intoxication while at work. But what needs to happen is that the testing procedure needs to be set out in more detail on the policy. So I first think the first thing that these intoxication policies should set out is that they have a zero tolerance. I don't think allowing for limits in policies is helpful. You often see policies that allow for one or two drinks or whatever the case may be.
Yes.
I think secondly, the policy must stipulate your test procedure. So this policy now, you would need to include for Dacha a particular testing method. So you would have in the policy a breathalyzer for alcohol, and then a urine test for maybe other drug use, and then a blood test for cannabis. I think that'll be the best way to set it out clearly, so that when a blood test is requested, the employee cannot turn around and say he was unaware that such a test might be asked for.
Yes.
I think the policy must go further than simply just setting out the test. The policy must state that the employer will take note of circumstantial evidence such as bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, the smell of alcohol in the breath, unsteadiness on his feet, you know, disheveled appearance, aggressive or abusive or arrogance, out of character behavior, inability to walk 10 meters and straight in a line. You can add in now, I mean, the bloodshot eyes as well would possibly be useful for the cannabis issue. And that might be something that you just need to work into slightly more.
Yes.
I think the level of productivity could also be mentioned in that policy.
Yes.
If productivity is being measured on a daily basis or KPIs are being taken weekly, is there a slump in that KPI and what is the result of that?
Yes.
In addition to the policy, we like to see not only a policy setting out what the actual policy is, but what we call a test sheet as well. And the test sheet should give almost like blocks for the employers to tick
yes
or no to various questions. And we recommend that when these tests are done, they're done in a private space at the workplace, in a boardroom, for example.
Yes.
And that the employer and the employee both have witnesses present. And it's very important for not only your employer clients, but your employee clients, that they make sure that there's a witness present at these tests to ensure that they are complied with fully. I mean, I don't know if there's anything more you want to talk about in terms of the policy.
Just right now, as we sit here and we have this discussion, assuming that policy has not been changed or not been amended into the detail that you've discussed now, you know, what can the employer recourse be? Can they take an employee on first warning, you know, verbal or written, etc., and up to the point of dismissing them if they do use cannabis at home? They do test positive, but it has not affected their work performance. They have obviously not shown aggressive behavior. They're not late. Nothing has changed for that employee. You know, what is that recourse for the employer? Because I think a lot of them talk about substance abuse and not intoxication necessarily. As point one, and number two, most of them have not amended their policy. So, you know, what is the scope of the employer's reach without this new detailed amended testing procedure and the new details on the contract?
I think it's very important in this regard when it comes to cannabis to distinguish between misconduct and incapacity. Because for charge for misconduct, it would be very difficult to charge someone for, the possession or use of cannabis at home with misconduct. Because it's not legal. It's not legal, and it's been done in their private space.
Yes.
If it's then resulting in incapacity, I mean, the employee's inability to perform their duties on a day-to-day basis, that would obviously be where it should fall under.
Yes.
If at all.
Yes. And you mentioned earlier that there should be certain specific reasons for doing this, the testing specifically. So I think you wanted to specify specifically that it can't be as because of victimization, etc. You want
to. So we can take, if we go back to Section 7 of the Employment Equity Act, if from our understanding of that section now, with the new judgment, is that if an employer wishes to institute random testing for cannabis, you would need to ensure that the testing is voluntary, confidential, and not motivated by victimization or unfair discrimination. You should understand now that if, and it is, cannabis use in the private space is not illegal.
Yes.
Then you can't pick on a particular employee because of that fact.
Yes.
And that would be seen as victimization.
Of course.
I think it's also important to remember that with any incapacity or misconduct, especially when it comes to dependence-producing substances, that item 3 of the Code of Good Practice for dismissals speaks to counseling and rehabilitation.
Yes.
And Section 3 or Item 3 makes it very clear that the degree of incapacity is relevant to the fairness of any dismissal. So that again speaks to the cannabis use, because what is the degree of incapacity that's
yes.
been caused by or believed to be caused by
yes.
the use of cannabis?
So it has to be treated on an individual
yep.
basis. You can't generalize and say this person is out of character perhaps once, you know, in the past 6 months, and then take that as grounds for full-on
yeah,
assault.
Definitely. Yeah. I think what I've found also to be helpful in these instances, now that we are stepping towards a more international way of approaching recreational drug use,
yeah.
if you will, is the International Labour Organization and their guidance for substance abuse policies.
Yes.
Although not directly applicable in South Africa, we can obviously turn to it
yes.
and find guidance in it. And just before anyone thinks that organization is for drug use or supports it or anyway, it's quite clear they've done testing that found that absenteeism in employees with alcohol or drug problems was 3 times higher than that of other employees, and that 20 to 25% of all injuries in the workplace involved employees under the influence of alcohol. And drugs and alcohol supplied at the workplace amounts to about 50 to 30% of all accidents at the workplace. So there's definitely an awareness of the issues that can be caused.
Yes, and from an international point of
yeah,
view. Yes,
absolutely.
And then what would be the employer's responsibility with regards to occupational health and safety? This specific case that you mentioned dealt with employees that were operating certain machinery, but in a normal office there is still that responsibility to comply with the occupational health and safety. You mentioned earlier the distinction between private space at home, or you know, the distinction between that and the workplace, and that the workplace is a public space. So what would the responsibility then be for an employer that has 50 or 100 office staff that are not operating
yeah.
machinery?
I think the general safety regulation, I think it's 2A1, is quite clear that the employer must... and depends on the circumstances, but he must not permit any person who is or appears to be under the influence of intoxicating liquor or drugs to enter or remain in the workplace. Now, again, how does one prove or show that someone is, for use of lack of a better term, intoxicated by cannabis
yes.
at a particular point?
Without, the only way would be through the proper
testing
procedures, and for that the contractual agreement should be in place between
correct.
Employer and employee.
But again, with the testing, and most employers are going to adopt a urine test or continue to adopt a urine test, must remember that even if that urine test is positive, there's no way, unless seeking an admittance of guilt from the employee, of proving that the employee at the time of being at the workplace was under particular influence. Substance and influence. So what might be possible, although not tested and not regularly seen, is a sort of policy that prohibits employees from smoking or consuming cannabis 2 to 3 hours before they attend at their particular place of employment.
Yes.
Although that might still even infringe on their right to privacy, depending on the nature and scope of their employment and the duties and responsibilities given to them while in their position of employment. So it's a very, at the moment, a very grey area. But what's not a grey area is that it is now legal.
Yes. And just, you know, from an employee point of view, someone, an employee, might have okayed the drug testing by, you know, signing that contract. But apparently no company cannot, at this stage, look at THC, the active ingredient in cannabis, because apparently THC now falls under your right to privacy. So, you know, is it true that they can't do anything without a THC test? Because, you know, the perception is there, even if I signed this new policy, THC falls under my right to privacy. What, do you agree with that?
Yeah, it does. I think it's similar to alcohol in some regards. So just as it would be, would it be reasonable to prohibit your employees from drinking any alcohol in the days or weeks before they come to their place of employment? Probably not. And in the same way, it wouldn't be reasonable to prohibit an employee from smoking cannabis or cultivating cannabis weeks or days before they attend at their particular place of employment. So it does become a rather grey area, because although it's similar to alcohol, the testing isn't and cannot be the same.
Yes.
Because the physical effects of the two particular drugs,
yes,
have different staying powers.
Of course. And would the employee be obliged to confess to the smoking of dacha at home if questioned? So we're talking about the employee's side of the coin. You know, I might have signed the new code of conduct and employment contract, but you know, the test must be voluntary, etc. We've gone through that, the requirements for proper testing. But am I obliged to confess to that because it's outside of the working environment? It's in the privacy of my home. It's my personal life. How is that? Am I obliged to disclose that to the employer?
I think it would again go back to your employment contract. So if you're being asked this question after having taken up employment, you obviously, standard clause in an employment contract requires you to be honest and act in good faith. And you would then be required to answer that question honestly. I think what would be necessary would be a follow-on question from the employee to say, well, why is that relevant? Why are you asking me this question?
Yes.
Do you wish to similarly inquire about my alcohol consumption in my personal time or how I spend the rest of my hours outside of the workplace,
yes,
conducting whatever activities I conduct? I think that would be the important follow-on question from the employee to ask. But I would always promote openness and honesty in that relationship, because if it does come out later that the employer has, or the employee has, misrepresented himself or herself, that might not work in his favor.
Yes.
I think the simple answer would be yes, he must answer such a question, but I think he would be entitled to a follow-on question to ascertain why the employer seeks an answer to that question. And remember, employers cannot now discriminate against employees who wish to partake in the consumption of cannabis in their personal spaces.
So I signed the new code of conduct, I signed the new employment contract, I get asked the question, I am honest about the use in privacy, and I get suspended or dismissed. What would be my recourse, if any, as an employee?
As an employee, you would obviously wish to utilize internal grievance procedure, if there is one. at your place of employment, and seek to use that to the full extent it provides you with. After which such time, I would suggest that referral to the CCMA takes place, and that particular employee states the reason for why they believe their dismissal was unfair, or whatever the circumstances are in the particular case, and they take that matter forward like they do.
Yes.
Bearing in mind that the wood chips case we discussed earlier, that's exactly what the employees did.
Yes.
But unfortunately, they didn't come right for various reasons.
Yes.
So there is obviously possibly a misunderstanding by the commissioners at the CCMA as to what the tests actually reveal and show.
Yes.
And as I wasn't there at the particular matter in Durban, I can't speak to the arguments made at the arbitration, but I think it was possibly due to a misunderstanding as to what is shown through the testing.
Yes. And for employers, if they include those pointers you mentioned earlier, and they now have the wording zero tolerance with a procedure on testing, as well as a check sheet on certain, you know, specific aspects that they should look out for and that would qualify a reason for testing, do you think that then gives them the carte blanche to effect consequences as per that signed contract?
If the employer has furthermore to simply setting out the test and the procedure, but in the employment contract, I would recommend that when the intoxication policy is mentioned, it is further mentioned that should there be a contravention of that policy, disciplinary action will follow, which may result in dismissal, so that there can be no
gray
area miscommunication, that the employee was unaware that should this policy be contravened, dismissal would be considered as an appropriate sanction.
Yes.
But there's also, I mean, there's various case law at the CCMA that has found that it's unnecessary for the employer to prove how much alcohol is being consumed, only that liquor was consumed, and the like. I think what needs to be considered as well is obviously a case-by-case basis. And there's a Metrorail case where the employee was dismissed on several charges of being under the influence of alcohol on duty, and the employee denied being under the influence or that he endangered any passengers. And it was clearly found that he was under the influence in these various instances. But during the hearing, it was revealed that the employee regularly worked shifts of 18 hours without a break. And the arbitrator found that under normal circumstances, dismissal in this case would have been justified.
Yes.
However, due to the conditions that he was working, his life consisted of working and sleeping, in essence. It was ruled that rather than dismissal, the employee should have addressed the root of the problem and should have changed the employee's working hours. And an employee was accordingly reinstated in employment retrospectively. It just shows that the employers and your clients must err on the side of caution and should conduct a proper and full investigation into the root cause of the issues.
Yes.
With a particular employee, and not just jump to the dismissal.
Of course. And would you say, in your opinion, that the employer has a first responsibility to offer employee wellness, assist with rehab or counseling as a first step prior to dismissal, or should the new policy that state zero tolerance be effected and implemented rather?
So there's going to have to be further reference to the Code of Good Practice, especially item 10.3, which stipulates very clearly that the appropriate steps to be considered when considering the degree of incapacity may be counseling or rehabilitation. So employers are advised to consult that Code of Good Practice, and if they're unaware, they're advised to seek a practitioner who understands it, like ourselves. And really get a sense of what their responsibilities are, given the level of intoxication. And that's why I refer to the case law, because the case law often gives us a better idea of where and what will be considered in a particular case. And it might be a case that, like in the Metrorail case, that the employees are being mistreated and mismanaged, and that's why they are turning to a substance abuse or forming a substance abuse problem.
Yes.
And that might then come back and bite the employer later down the line.
Caleb, thank you very much for your time. Should our listeners, clients and candidates, employees, want to get in contact with you, what would be the best way for them to contact you and to get further advice?
So it would probably be via email. So it would be Caleb, C-A-L-E-B dot M-C-K-E-L-L-A-R at APAA.co.za. But I think we'll put up all our contact details on the post, and
yes,
your listeners a better option to contact us. Yeah,
definitely. Thank you for joining us today and discussing this very controversial matter. And we hope to chat to you again
in
the future soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Cool.